Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For all of you high information people, we are covering the conventions. We spent last week spending several days analyzing the speakers before the Republican National Convention, and had a Democrat critique the Republican convention the last hour. This week we have Republicans critiquing the Democratic convention the last hour before we hear the president tonight. We'll have two guests with us this hour of the program. David Winston, president of the Winston Group, frequent guest on this program, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership. And later this hour, Michael Warren, a reporter for the Weekly Standard. We'll be welcoming phone calls as we always do. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to use that. And put your comments on about all that's been going on politically on Facebook, because I know that we like to read what you're thinking, and other people like to read what you're thinking, because we think about all of these issues. So did I give you that address? It's the Kathleen Dunn Show. David Winston, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Okay. I survived Tampa. For those who haven't been to conventions, it really is an incredible drain, in the sense of there's just all this stuff going on, and you're supposed to be in 19 different places at the same time. So when you finally finish up, you're just happy to have some downtime.
I would imagine. And you don't sleep very much, I would imagine, because you've got yet another great political conversation right across the hall.
Yeah, no, you get minimal amount of sleep, and of course the other dynamic is, like you said, everybody wants to talk about it, and it's like, you know, well, I do want to go to sleep here eventually, but anyway.
Well, I hope you can catch up, but you have to now be a person who's looking at this convention pretty carefully,
yeah,
too, so you figure out what to do tomorrow. Let's start with Clinton, who, the guy, no matter what your political persuasion, anybody who can talk for that long and have people still listen to him is pretty remarkable. He can talk, can he?
Yeah, no, he's very good at it. And last night I thought was a good example of his strength. One of the reasons,
yes,
he did so well in the 90s, I mean, he has a way of, and I would argue with some of his facts, but looking at the broader way of his presentation, he lays out facts in terms of policy, then sets up the broader picture. I mean, he did a very good job. And again, having worked for Newt when he was Speaker, when Clinton was President, he's a very engaging person who really does sit down and think through that policy side of it. And again, you can agree or disagree with him, but he is clearly someone who can engage and is engaging.
Mm-hmm. And Newt's a policy guy too. So I can see how the two of them.
Yeah, putting the two of them in a room was like, you know, and the rest of it, like, okay, you know, eventually this will end and we'll, like, get back to whatever. And they would just go, you know, go back and forth for a while. But again, it gives you that sense of, I mean, one of the things that I think he showed last night that I thought was probably beneficial to the Democratic Party was just this intellectual curiosity in terms of policy that I think sometimes is missing from the political discourse at this point. And I thought for Democrats and the Democratic Party, that was probably helpful.
Mm-hmm. What about were they playing loose with the facts at all, any of the speakers, or have they organized a pretty good convention?
And this is where, you know, I'm wearing my Republican hat, okay? I wouldn't say loose with the facts, but their interpretation of the facts. So, for example, Pick an example. I'm sure there'll be people out there that disagree. When you take a look in terms of what happened during the Clinton years, you know, there was a Republican majority in the House and the Senate. And when you take a look at those balanced budgets that occurred after the 97 tax cut, that would be my interpretation, right? Obviously, the president would say, well, no, it was sort of the totality of the things I was doing prior to that. But I would say that the one thing that I think he helped, and for both sides, no matter where you are, is by the interjection of those facts, it starts being about policy. What's the impact? Okay, so one person says this happens with their policy. Here's what another person says happened. And you can get into that discussion as opposed to name-calling. And I think one of the things that you saw occur from about April forward were both the presidential campaigns, both Governor Romney and President Obama, just firing stuff back and forth at each other in terms of negatives. And I think you watched sort of this political equilibrium emerge as people just tuned out. I mean, this was not the conversation they wanted. And so what you're seeing now, both in terms of Paul Ryan, you can agree or disagree with him. The President Clinton, you can agree or disagree with him. But at least we're getting to some real discussion about, okay, here's a policy. What happened as a result of that? Do you agree with that? Where is your disagreement? And so it's a much more substantive conversation, potentially.
And will that make us vote, or does it get too substantive and we just want something that's pretty easy?
No, I think in this environment, no matter where you are in the political spectrum or which party, given the seriousness in terms of the problems the country's facing, I think people want a really serious conversation. And I think they found it very frustrating from both sides that in fact what they were, you know, when you're talking about, okay, it's about tax returns, okay, it's about, what role did Obama's father play in terms of whatever the thing was, in terms of imperialism or whatever. Those sort of conversations were just like, what does that have to do with the decision I have to make in terms of the direction of the country? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, one of the themes of last night, at least from Clinton, was that Obama was handed this big mess 4 years ago, and heavens knows it takes more than 4 years to clean up that kind of mess. And it's interesting to me that Clinton had to, it seems to me, make that case more than Obama has made that case, that he's been reluctant to talk about what he has done. Are the American people willing to give him another 4 years because the mess was so bad? Was Clinton overstating what the mess was? Can a president accomplish a great deal in 4 years?
A lot of questions.
Yeah, they were just rolling off their words. Sorry, David.
A lot of questions there to sort of deal with. Let me sort of give a sense of where I think the electorate's at and then sort of move forward. I mean, first off, the president came in, we were losing 600,000-700,000 jobs a month, right? I mean, and there was just a sense of pure panic. And so from that point of view, are we losing 600,000-700,000 jobs a month? No, right? And obviously people are relieved that that's not occurring. Having said that, we've never had a president who the unemployment rate, in his case, it's never been under 8%, and that's never occurred before since they've been recording that number. So people are really unhappy with the direction of the economy. Having said that, they are unwilling to play 52-card pickup with the economy, i.e. just go to somebody else for the sake of doing it. And that was sort of the challenge to the Romney team in terms of sort of coming up with an alternative, which you saw him change his strategy. The Romney team originally was saying, we're going to make this a referendum about the president, and that clearly wasn't working. So they decided they're going to come up with an alternative, and now I think what you're watching, and Romney laid out a bit of what that might look like in terms of the convention. We'll see what the president does tonight in terms of response to that, setting up this potential choice between two alternatives. That's where the American public wants to go. They want to see what this choice is, and they want to see a real full-scale policy engagement. They see the problems that exist, but they're looking for solutions at this point, and we'll see how that evolves tonight. I think that's one of the challenges to the president tonight. How much does he try to set up the choice the way, obviously, he would like to set that up, versus how partisan does it get? And to some degree, my sense was they tried to dump some of the partisan stuff onto President Clinton to just sort of lay out, as Clinton sort of walked through, kind of here's what was said down in Tampa, mainly because I think there was a sense that he could handle that particular part of it perhaps a little bit differently than the president would have to do in terms of standing up there and having to say some of those harsher statements. Mm-hmm. So I guess I go back to, I mean, this is a public at this point who really wants to see what their options are, and they really want candidates to stop pointing fingers at each other and start saying, this is what I'm going to do. And I think what you, again, going back to, I don't mean to repeat, but going back to the sense of what's occurred over the past couple of months, both campaigns were remarkably unsatisfying in terms of what the public wanted.
Hmm. And tonight, I think it was Deval Patrick's speech in which he talked about the Democratic Party really needing a backbone, and you need to get up there, and I think the Republicans may be better with this, tell people what you stand for, what your ideas are, this is who we are, and the Democrats are, well, we're this and we're that, and we don't say too much about what we stand for. We used to, but we don't do that anymore. Did he have a point? Are the Republicans better at doing that? And would it be good for the president to really talk about what he stands for now and what he would stand for during a second term?
I'm going to do that in reverse order. I think he should do that. I think he is capable of that. I won't necessarily agree with everything he says for obvious reasons, but I think that's a direction. I'm not sure the Republicans are any better at it. I'm going to give you a slightly different take. I think that from both sides, the sort of political consulting community has basically tried to say to people of both parties, you know, you really don't want to put something out there that the other side can shoot at.
Mm.
Right? And so they've been sort of, the candidates, you know, well, I want to talk about this. No, you know, you may get some negative pushback in terms of that. And so they've been sort of weaned away from going out and sort of taking those positions. And I would suggest that's true for both parties. And I think one of the things that's sort of occurring here is you're actually seeing, to some degree, the candidates kind of assert themselves. I mean, again, you had the president yesterday saying, no, this is what I want in the platform, right? I don't know what you all thought
right,
you were doing, but
right.
this is what I want in the platform. And I would suggest the same thing Mitt Romney did in terms of choosing Paul Ryan. Why not a safe choice? Well, you know, if I'm going to go out there and make an alternative, let's get somebody on the ticket who clearly is identified as a policy person. And so you're sort of seeing the two individuals there sort of potentially assert themselves against a consulting community that is not particularly comfortable in trying to pitch what a candidate is for. They're very good at attacking opponents, but this is now an environment where the public wants to know what you're for, and I would suggest that both sides, both political consulting communities, this is not something they're particularly used to.
Hmm. Both the Republicans and the Democrats were hoping for some kind of boost, significant boost from their respective conventions. Indications are that's not going to happen for either of the parties. So my question to you is, considering that this, according to all polls, is a very, very close race,
yes.
What is it that will need to happen for the Republicans to win? What is it that needs to happen for the Democrat? What's their path to victory here, David?
Well, I think what's going to happen, and we'll see what the president does tonight, but the reason you haven't seen, there was minimal movement in terms of what happened in terms of Tampa. I expect there'll be some minimal movement in terms of what happens tonight. Not so much that they don't deliver good speeches and people are engaged by them, but I think people are taking a measure of the situation in a way perhaps they haven't before because of the serious nature of it. And so they want to see what both sides are saying and sort of weigh through what they think is the best direction here. Having said that, I mean, the president has a huge risk here in terms of for those who don't really, tomorrow is the monthly jobs
right.
numbers report, right? And so he could either have a really great multiplier in the sense of, okay, he does a good speech, and then all of a sudden there's a good number tomorrow, and so everything sort of, you know, multiplies. Or it could be the inverse. He has a good speech, and then there's a bad number, and everybody just talks about the number, and who knows what happened in terms of the speech. So he does have a pretty big risk here. Of course, he could maybe have not a great speech either. But it you know, my sense is most people, when they stand up to deliver that speech, at worst, it's good, right?
you're right.
Right. So where I sense the public is at is they're doing something different. And again, this goes back to a lot of the media and a lot of the political consultants not used to this. They're actually taking a measured look in terms of what these two individuals are going to be saying and trying to really think through it. I mean, people are really concerned about where this country is going. They've seen, you know, when you've looked at, 42 months of 8% unemployment or higher, that's a very serious statement in terms of where we are. And they're going to be very measured in terms of thinking through where they go. And I would suggest here the debates will play a huge role here.
When are the debates, David?
They begin in October, and there'll be two presidential and then one vice presidential. And those will be big moments. And again, having come through that, having done the Republican side of this, those are going to be big moments. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so, and they should be. And I think and the public will have pay huge attention to them. And they'll be big deals.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's welcome phone calls for David. David Winston is our guest, president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership. Later this hour, Michael Warren, a reporter for the Weekly Standard, will be joining us. We're getting a Republican response to what they've been watching in Charlotte, as we got a Democratic response to what was happening in Tampa, as we covered last week's Republican convention. I love doing this. It's just so, I just love it. And I know that many of you do, too. We're high information voters. So all of you high information voters, give us a call. Tell us what your thoughts are. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. We should have at least one email today, huh? And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for David Winston. And starting with John in Eagle River. Hi, John.
Morning.
Hi.
How are you all?
All right, how are you?
Good, good, good. I'm a Republican who actually is going to switch and vote for Obama this time. I didn't vote for him last time, but the reason is, and I wanted to know what your guess, the strategy of the Republicans, that I've watched the Congress basically block every initiative of the Democrats in the last 2 years, and then start telling the nation that Obama hasn't done anything, or the Democrats haven't done anything. I mean, how can they do something when, you know, the votes are stacked against them? And was that a strategy that your friend David was involved in, or who came up with that strategy? Because the public isn't that stupid.
David.
Well, I think what John's referring to, I mean, there's a clear difference of opinion, and this is no surprise to anybody, in terms of where House Republicans wanted to go in terms of the economy and where the president wanted to go. And I think one of the elements that emerged here, and we almost got to that big deal, right? And I don't think people, and actually Bob Woodward is about to release a book, I think, this week, sort of getting into the details of how close we came to that big deal. And ultimately, there were elements there that didn't let that cause that not to occur. And when you have disagreements at that scale, one of the elements that also is in existence at this point, where there is not a reward for either side in terms of the party to actually sort of work through how do you get to a conclusion, to get to some sort of agreement. Having said that, because both sides were being asked to do things that they thought were fundamentally wrong, again, in this particular case, the Speaker basically thought that by increasing taxes, you were going to really hurt the economy. And the President viewed that there was no way to be able to get to a balanced budget without increasing taxes. And so you had that particular conflict that clearly was not resolved. And I think part of what needs to occur here is you're going to have some political discourse and discussion during the course of this campaign that will give at least the elected leaders some sense of where the American public wants to go. I would suggest that sometimes you really do have serious policy differences that you need to have further discussion with the American public with to sort of get the sense of where they want to go. And that's what I think occurred. Having said that, I think John also reflects a frustration that a lot of the public has of why can't we move things forward? And hopefully what we'll see in terms of this political discourse is that motivation to be able to allow that to happen.
And some have said, David, please respond to this, it's because of the makeup of the people who won in 2010 midterm, that the Republicans who were elected were much more conservative, were more closely aligned with the Tea Party, and really have made it difficult for there to be any kind of compromise. Is there truth in that?
I'll go back to something slightly different. Just to give you a context, one of the things that was interesting when you looked at the exit polls, which is the polls that the networks do and news organizations do to sort of get a sense of what the electorate looks like. One of the things that was interesting in terms of the 2010 election was for the first time you actually saw more conservatives as a percentage of the electorate than moderates. I mean, historically, you've had, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of like 50% moderate, 34% conservative. So it was that range. Last time around, it was actually flipped. So I think to some degree, you saw those individuals reflecting who that electorate was. And so, yes, they were more conservative, specifically in terms of the economic side. Having said that, when they walked in, they felt they were elected to do certain things. And part of what you watch in terms of that process is as things began to emerge, ultimately, for example, they ultimately did come to an agreement in terms of the debt ceiling. They ultimately did come to an agreement in terms of the spending bills. But it's the process of this is how I got elected and how do I govern. And I think you watch them go through that process, as particularly when you have that many new people. I mean, there were a lot of freshmen in that particular class. But the other thing, too, you had a president who did not respond, and I would suggest this is the one difference in terms of where I would disagree with President Clinton last night. This was not a president that was willing to change his direction and sort of accommodate what the new political dynamic was, instead decided that he was going to continue the same direction, whereas President Clinton, after the 94 election, very, very much did sort of figure out how was he going to accommodate the situation so he could effectively govern. Mm-hmm. And he came out with perhaps still to this day one of the most amazing lines that I'd seen in the State of the Union, where he did the line, "The era of big government is over." I would suggest that President Obama would have a much more difficult time with that statement.
Yeah. Well, part of the problem is the tax spending thing here, right, that you've got a completely different philosophical viewpoint on that issue. And how much can you do if you can't compromise on that?
Yeah, and I think that is a dynamic that I think you will see this election potentially getting input from the electorate in terms of where they want people to go, and you're right. Right now, at this point, there's a very different view, and I'll give you the Republican side of this. I'm sure there'll be people out there who disagree, but again, this idea that increasing taxes and increasing revenues are two separate things, i.e., that you set tax rates to generate level of economic activity. That being the sort of Republican focus, right, versus Democrats saying, look, if you're going to raise money, you need to raise taxes to make sure that those individuals who have those resources can pay, and that's the way you do it. You're right, that's a very deep philosophical difference. And right now, for both sides, there's not a, for lack of a better phrase, there's not a reward in terms of how do you begin to resolve that difference.
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. Greg in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hello. I have a viewpoint about this. I'm going to vote for Obama myself. And the reason why is I look at the history of the two people. Obama worked for social services before he got into politics. Romney actually literally shut down companies. As a capitalist, he bought companies, he shut them down, took American jobs, moved them overseas also, and he shouldn't be running for dog catcher. I don't care what you say. I can't vote for him. He shouldn't be running for dog catcher. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. David.
Well, two things. One element, and you and I have had this discussion before. At a personal level, the president is very popular, right? I mean, people like him. One of the challenges for Republicans, and I would suggest this was one of the elements in terms of the Republican convention, that I thought interesting but not necessarily as central, and that is if it's a personality contest, the president has got pretty good standing. And I think John McCain, who probably had one of the best bios you could ever have, the president proved that last time. Ultimately, the challenge, I think, for Republicans is to make this more about policy. Having said that, in terms of thinking through how do you set that contrast up and make that alternative, that was something that the Romney team just came to. And like I said, they changed their strategy. They were going to try to make this a referendum. Now they're going to make this an alternative and potentially about policy. I'm also going to suggest just sort of across the board, but no matter where you are in the spectrum, the idea of having a much more substantive policy debate. And the one thing I would sort of go back to Greg and say that's fine that you find those personality differences, but ultimately I would suggest where the American public is at, they want to know what is the president going to do to actually improve things versus what Romney is suggesting he would do to improve things.
Mm-hmm. I need to ask you, maybe it's just because I'm so much in the thick of this, living in the state of Wisconsin and people in swing states will be. I just can't believe the amount of money that's being spent on television ads, David. It is just, I can't believe that people aren't just tuning those out.
They are.
Well, that was direct. You think they are?
Yeah, because it's not addressing the concerns that they're focusing. Here's one of the things. Okay, and then this may be I am not a fan of the candidate issue, super PACs. Right. I mean, you've got some issue super PACs that sort of go out and do things and push points of view. That's one thing. And the reason I have difficulty with these super PACs is because ultimately, for your listenership, these super PACs can raise unlimited amount of money. And they're not allowed to talk to the campaign, right? So you have this entity out there working for either President Obama or Governor Romney, right, who aren't allowed to talk to the candidate, so they just go off and make stuff up. I don't mean make stuff up in terms of like lying about things, but I mean they just go off in a direction in terms of what they want to talk about. Most of the time, most of that stuff is negative. Okay, so that if they're dramatically outraising what the campaigns are getting, then what are you going to get? A predominantly negative campaign, right, from both sides, mm-hmm. and that's not what the public wants. The other thing, too, that I think that ultimately does that I really have a problem with, that is if you have the super PACs raising a lot more money than the campaigns themselves, the campaigns can't have any say in what the super PACs are saying, that just diminishes candidate voice, and I think that's a real problem. And that really concerns me. And so going to your point, there are a lot of ads on TV at this point that, you know, maybe the hardcore bases of both political parties like, but those people who are really trying to figure out who to vote for, it's just a really frustrating sound.
Right. Well, David, please join us after the debates, won't you?
Okay, I'd love to.
Good.
Good talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks, David. Great talking to you as always. David Winston, president of the Winston Group, strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership. Our guest, the first part of this hour, Michael Warren is joining us momentarily. He is a reporter for the Weekly Standard. Stay on the line, everybody. Your phone calls will still be applicable to this conversation as we are getting a Republican response to the Democratic National Convention this week. And we're getting your thoughts, too, on what you've thought about the convention. And we're getting pretty close now. I guess tomorrow will be the day when we're in full campaign swing. The conventions are over, and what are the themes that the conventions have presented, and what will the candidates use in terms of fact-checking what happened at each convention and what material they may be using in their campaigns that has come as a result of what's happened this week in Charlotte and last week in Tampa. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and the Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Michael Warren, hello.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm fine, Michael. How are you?
Just fantastic, right here in Charlotte, North Carolina, on the last day of the convention.
Last day of the convention. Are you worn out? Everybody is saying they've had a few too many parties and too many late nights, or are you loving it?
Well, you know, I'm a professional, so I keep it pretty professional. You know, go to the events, go to the speeches, write them up, go home, go to sleep like a responsible journalist.
All right, Michael. No parties for you, I'm sure. How can you keep from going to some of those? All right, of all the people you've heard so far at the Democratic National Convention, who are the Republicans most worried about, meaning who was the most effective, and who could you just fact check and have 10 pages of inconsistencies on your report?
You know, I'd have to say, for both of those questions, the same person, Bill Clinton.
Really?
You know, yeah, yes. I think that, well, look, Bill Clinton is the only Democrat to have won re-election to the presidency, you know, since FDR, to win actually two consecutive terms to the presidency. So he's a huge threat just in his pedigree. The Republicans, and the speech that he gave last night, I think, is shows you why he's such a force to be reckoned with. And so in many ways, that speech that he gave last night, it was long and it was a bit rambling, and it was classic Clinton. I think really may have reminded viewers, if they're out there watching, just what a Clinton style, a 90s style Democrat looks like, and so he's a threat in that way to the Republicans. But also, sort of the same side of the coin, there are a lot of inconsistencies. I mean, this is Bill Clinton we're talking about here, and in many ways, people, you know, if they see him as sort of the harbinger of all the prosperity of the 90s, he was also the guy who was impeached, the guy who was who was disbarred because of lying under oath. So he's sort of a double-edged sword in many ways. And so I really loved the speech last night. It was classic Clinton. It was classic political theater. I guess it will remain to be seen how many people are watching it and how many people will be affected by it.
Yeah. And what about from the Republican National Convention? Who was the standout?
I think that the Marco Rubio speech on the last night of the convention, following Clint Eastwood's sort of performance art piece. I really think Rubio was definitely the strongest speaker. I don't think that that says anything bad about how Paul Ryan did, the vice presidential candidate, and I think Mitt Romney did a serviceable job in his acceptance speech. But you know, Rubio really, I think, blew people away because he was vintage Rubio. I mean, I remember interviewing Marco Rubio when he was way down on Charlie Crist in the polls in 2009, and he's just only gotten stronger. He's only gotten more serious, and I think he had a message that was that can resonate, you know, sort of beyond the conservative base that certainly loves him and loves what he's doing in the Senate. So, good face, good young face, good future of the party, I think, and he got a nice prime time spot to demonstrate that.
Mm. I can't remember who wrote this. I read too much about all of this, and it gets jumbled after a while. But somebody was writing about comparing Marco Rubio and Julian Castro and their similar backgrounds, immigrant kinds of backgrounds, but also were touting them as being, this is the face of the parties that we need to pay attention to, that there's something that's not as intransigent about both of them. And if you got them together, you would find that they would have much more in common and might be able to work together better than the current crop, whoever they may be. What do you think of that?
You know, I'm pretty skeptical that there's ever going to be some mass sea change in the way our politics works. You know, I think Marco Rubio is a stand-up guy. I don't know much about Julian Castro. Seems like a stand-up guy as well. But you know, just because they're young and up-and-coming and exciting new faces, you know, doesn't mean that politics doesn't rear its ugly head when they get in the reins of power. That being said, you know, I think that in many ways they represent a new generation that is you know, maybe a little less cynical about politics, at least at this point,
mm-hmm.
than the current generation. You know, they're really sort of the Gen X politicians, and I honestly would fit Paul Ryan into that mold as well. These are young politicians who look at, I think, the previous generation, the baby boomers, the late baby boomers, and say, you know, we're not really interested in engaging in what they're engaging in. You know, we're more interested in solving problems. I think you see that in Paul Ryan's efforts to address Medicare and the spending spree that's going on with Medicare, and how spending is sort of spiraling out of control with that program, and trying to find ways to address it. And I think Julian Castro, in many ways, is trying to put a nicer face on in some of these red states on the Democratic Party. You know, in Texas, he thinks Texas could even be a purple state in a few years.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true, but you know, he's putting a different face on red state Democratic politics,
mm-hmm.
than has been there.
You mentioned Medicare. The president, former president, talked about that yesterday, and certainly Paul Ryan has talked a lot about that. David Winston, our previous guest, was saying that what we really want as an American population right now, and we will demand it of the campaign as it begins more in earnest, is a discussion. It may be kind of a wonky policy discussion, but that's what we want to hear on those issues like Medicare, on health care, et cetera. Would you agree? Is that what we're hungry for right now, to hear the clear differences between the parties on policy areas?
You know, I sure hope so. I think we're beginning to see that. It's just a matter of leadership from our politicians, from the people who ought to be engaging us in that discussion. You know, I was pretty disheartened to see when Paul Ryan was named as the vice presidential candidate for Mitt Romney. You know, within a few days, I mean, the old attacks on his Medicare plan were out, you know, that he was going to end Medicare as we know it. You know, from my vantage point, that's not a serious discussion of what's actually happening with Medicare. You know, many of the reasons that healthcare costs are spiraling out of control is that the way that Medicare is set up makes it so that healthcare costs increase, and Paul Ryan is trying to address that, and there's a Democratic response to that. There's a Democratic liberal way of saying, you know, that's not the way to address entitlement reform. But we're not really hearing much about that. We're hearing more about how Paul Ryan lied about 716 billion dollars taken away from Medicare through the president's health care plan. How well Paul Ryan actually keeps that in his budget. I mean, this is sort of the boring minutia of budget policy that doesn't seem to me to address any of the actual issues, which are, you know, spiraling health care costs, spiraling Medicare costs that Paul Ryan, at least, and other Republicans and some Democrats too, like Ron Wyden from Oregon, seem to want to address. I'm a little cynical that we can actually get that conversation going, but you know, I think Paul Ryan in many ways represents at least an effort to start it.
Michael Warren, our guest now, reporter for the Weekly Standard, and we're going to go to more phone calls. 800-486-8655. Don in West Salem is your first caller, Michael. Hi, Don.
Hi.
Hi.
Basically, I just wanted to say is the majority of the rich have gotten lazy and stupid. They're not starting businesses like they're supposed to, like their predecessors. They're what used to drive the country. They want more money by getting tax breaks instead of starting new businesses and hiring new employees. If you're too lazy to start a new business to make more money, you shouldn't get any more tax breaks.
All right, Don, thanks for the call. Michael.
Well, look, we're talking about having serious conversations about the issues that face us, and I think there are really two different philosophies that we're trying to debate out here about the role of government and the amount of tax income and spending and expenditures that the government engages in. I don't know about what the caller said about business owners being lazy and rich people being lazy. That doesn't strike me as reflective of what, you know, small business owners that I know and I've met are like in their personality. I mean, a lot of these people are driven, yes, by the profit motive, but they're also driven because they're interested in whatever business that they're creating. If they're creating a product or innovating a product or providing a new kind of service, I mean, they have a hunger for doing these things and engaging in business. But the Republican argument on this is that if you don't provide a climate that says, you know, here we're going to encourage you to do this. We're going to, lay off the regulations. We're going to make sure your taxes stay where they are. You know, the caller mentioned that they're lazy. I think a lot of business owners are just unsure of what's going to happen. The sole issue of what tax rates are going to be is in flux every 6 months, it seems like, because there doesn't seem to be a consensus on this. So in many ways, I think we have to figure out where it is that we stand on this as a country, and I think the 2012 election is a representation of us figuring this out. Do we want the sort of tax rates that President Obama advocates for, or do we want the tax rates and the ideas for tax reform that the Republicans are advocating for? And it's a real debate. It's a meaty debate, and I don't know if we get anywhere by saying that rich people are lazy. It's just doesn't really jive with reality for me.
Well, could we say that rich people are holding on to their money?
Yeah, I think they are. I think they are. But I think to ascribe motives that are, that are malicious, I think misunderstands what drives these people who start businesses. They're holding on to their money, and in many ways, I think, because they're unsure of what the future is going to look like. And I'd say if any of us were in their situation, we might do the same thing. These people don't want to just hold on to their money and not play a part in their communities by hiring people and providing services or products. But I do think Republicans need to make that point a little better. That businessmen and businesswomen and entrepreneurs are also community members too. And so, make the case that lower taxes and fewer regulations are about creating better business climates and better communities that we live in on the small level, not just at the macro level. So this is a blind spot, I think, in a lot of ways for Republicans. They don't know how to talk about innovation. They seem to always want to just say, well, we're for business. I think they need to make an argument that being for business is about being for communities and being for growth as well.
Michael Warren, our guest this half hour, reporter for the Weekly Standard, joining us by phone from Charlotte, North Carolina, where he is this week covering the Democratic National Convention. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. I want to talk a little bit about the gender gap. We were playing some of the speeches from last night's Democratic National Convention. This is Cecile Richards, who is the president of Planned Parenthood, on what she talked about as Romney and Ryan on women's issues, and then let's get a response and talk about the gender gap and how the Republicans deal with that.
So Mr. Romney and Mr. Ryan are campaigning for women's votes by saying that women need their help. Okay, this is coming from two men who are committed to ending insurance coverage for birth control, who would turn women's health care decisions over to our bosses, and who won't even stand up for equal pay for women. Okay, well, as my grandmother back in Texas would have said, any more help from Mitt Romney, and I'm going to have to take in ironing.
Michael, you want to address those comments? There were a number of them at the Democratic National Convention, and polls are showing, and some commentators are saying, that if enough women turn out to vote, that Romney is going to lose this election. How do the Republicans fashion a message that will appeal to getting more women to turn their way?
Well, I think first it's worth addressing a misconception on this gender gap between the parties. I think the president, President Obama, and Democrats always do well overall with women, and they do well with particularly single women. But if you look at married women and how married women, women who are married, who have kids, who maybe have grandkids as well, the gap is much, much narrower.
And they're up 4 points in that area, I understand.
Exactly. I was going to say, in a recent poll, I think Romney was ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So when people like representatives of Planned Parenthood get up and talk about the women vote, I think they're talking about a very particular women vote. I'm not saying it's a small number of women, but it is a subset, I think, of the female vote. And look, the pitch that Republicans are making is that women don't care about issues like access to contraception, because there is no Republican plan to get rid of access to contraception. I think that Romney's addressed that pretty plainly and clearly as he can. There doesn't seem to be any effort to ban contraception. The question really is about federal funding and the federal government forcing insurance providers to necessarily provide certain types of insurance coverage of contraception, birth control, these sort of things. So it really becomes, in many ways, a religious rights issue, a federal government involved in the economy issue, And look, there are plenty of women out there for whom issues like Planned Parenthood's federal funding are not an issue. So I think that to address this for the Republicans, it may be a waste of time. Look, women for whom Planned Parenthood's federal funding is a huge issue are going to be voting for Obama no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Romney can say anything to convince them otherwise, because in general these are liberal women. These are women who vote for Democrats pretty regularly. So I don't think the Romney campaign needs to worry so much about getting the women vote. I think they need to worry about turning out the white majority of middle class votes. And that's, I think, what they're trying to do with their economic argument. We'll see if it works.
Ernest in Superior, our next caller. Hi, Ernest.
Hey, how you doing?
All right. How are you?
Fine. Now, I heard your guests speak about the rich and talking about they aren't sure about what the tax situation is going to be. But for the last 3 years, President Obama have lowered the taxes for small business more than in the last 30 years. And plus, in the last 30 years, we have been giving the rich and the billionaires tax breaks. So I must not be in reality, or your guess must not be in reality, because I think since President Obama has been in office, that's his policy.
All right, let's get a response. Your phone is a little cracking up there. What about that, that the president already has lowered taxes for small businesses? Michael.
Yeah, and I had a little bit of trouble understanding.
I know, it was staticky.
But to address that point, look, for the last 3 years, the tax situation going forward has been in limbo. I think the thing that people ought to understand about business owners is they don't look 2 years ahead. They don't look 5 years ahead. They look 10 years ahead. They look 15 and 20 years ahead. And so there is a level of uncertainty because every single fight to either extend the Bush-era tax cuts of 01 and 03 or to let them expire has been a long, protracted fight, again, because this is a big debate that I don't think Americans have entirely decided what side they fall on. So in many ways, I think you can attribute a lot of the economic stagnation over the last three and a half years to this level of uncertainty. I think the caller mentioned that President Obama lowered taxes on small businesses, but if you have to look at the entire package, if you look at the president's health care plan, there are a lot of hidden taxes and fees inherent in that plan. You're talking about a small business where that business has 50 or more employees, the level of health insurance coverage that employer is required to provide suddenly jumps up. That has a lot to do with business decisions that business owner may make in the next year, 2, 5, 10 years. So I think there was a consensus about taxes for much of the time that the caller was talking about in the last 30 years. And that's been shaken up ever since the Bush administration decided to make those tax cuts, and they weren't able to make them permanent. They have to renew them now every few years, and it's just a big long fight, and that seems to be what's causing a lot of the uncertainty.
Thanks, Ernest. Aaron in Chicago. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Okay.
Two things. I guess first of all, the number one question I have is, when I look at what's hurting us economically, and I have a small business, it's local government regulations and rules and the changes that go on there that make us the most risk-averse. And it just seems like when you look at a federal government, you got all these people that are very well-educated, and their policies, regardless of whether or not they're Democrat or Republican, really don't have a rubber-meets-the-road impact on what we do on a day-to-day basis. But health department regulations or municipality regulations or fines or that type of thing, that kills us, absolutely kills us. The other thing that I have is, like, when I look at Paul Ryan, I also work in the world of pension. I look at Social Security, and it is a huge enigma to us, given how they're funded, how in the world they could be underfunded. I mean, if you were to, present value out payment streams that these people are making into this pension plan, how in the world are we having to raise the retirement age? I mean, I really feel like science is gone out of politics. And I'll take my question off.
Thanks, Aaron.
Don't hang up on me, because I'm out of your listener area, and I'm listening to this.
Oh, don't hang up on you? Okay.
At least at home. Yeah, I want to hear this.
You want to hear it on your phone. Gotcha. About a minute for a response. Michael?
Regarding the problems with local governments, municipal governments, and a lot of states, it's state governments, that I think the caller is exactly right about how those regulations that are really close to home in communities and in their states can be the most impactful. I think you're seeing a lot of that borne out in the debates over public sector employee pension programs that keep getting more costly. You see this in, of course, in Wisconsin and New Jersey, and these debates over whether or not taxes ought to be raised to fund these pension programs. And I'm sure the caller knows much better than I do about how health departments and other local regulations hurt businesses. And I'm sorry, I didn't catch the end of the second part of his question. Is he asking about social
security? I'm sorry, we won't be able to get to it because we're plumb out of time. But
sure.
You got a good answer to the first part of the question, Michael. Thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to be here.
Michael Warren, a reporter for Weekly Standard, joining us from Charlotte, North Carolina, where he's covering the convention, and David Winston earlier, president of the Winston Group and strategic advisor to Senate and House Republican leadership. Oh, those hours went so fast. They were really interesting, weren't they? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Brett Jaspers, who produced this program. Great conversations ahead. And I'll be with you again on Monday, where we'll go at it all again with all things political. Thanks very much for listening.